Hello. To kick off the third season of the My Imaginary University podcast, we have higher education consultant Hugh Jones, who gives us an idea of what it would be like to study at a very serious institution, the University of Life. No, not that one that people down the pub seem to have been to, but a real, okay, not actually real, university founded on the idea of the power of education to transform the individual. Teaching and learning are very different from the norm and highly tailored to individual needs. And the learning and living facilities are outstanding in the traditional manor house campus environment. It is a small but perfectly formed university with a very big endowment, and while there is some collective activity, much of the responsibility for working hard sits with each student who is driving their own learning journey. It is then a serious place with a high level of applicant demand and little in the way of frivolity for learners, unless it's related directly to your studies. No one's allowed to coast, and if there's any idling, then the Vice-Chancellor will be on to you. He likes to wander around to ensure staff and students are all working hard. It is certainly a disciplined and focused environment, but one where every student is supported with outstanding teaching and facilities to achieve their goals. And it has a distinctive highbrow anthem too. Welcome to the real University of Life.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode, the first in season three of My Imaginary University. And this time my guest is Hugh Jones. Hugh is a higher education consultant of long standing, formerly occupied the position of Chief Operating Officer at Cardiff University, and before that he was Registrar and Secretary at Goldsmiths, University of London. But he has spent many years as a consultant, is also in his spare time the famous wrangler of the wonky higher education postcard, which I'm sure many listeners will be aware of. So welcome, Hugh, to My Imaginary University.
Thank you very much, Paul, and thank you for asking me to come on.
Well, the exciting thing about My Imaginary University is, of course, that Hugh will create an imaginary institution entirely from his own mind. I have no idea what he's going to talk about. We've not discussed it in advance. So it's a journey of mutual exploration for all of us. So I'm going to dive straight in with some of the questions that I've prepared to ask him, and we'll see what he's come up with. So let's start with a very broad opener then, Hugh, and you can tell us all about the nature of your imaginary university, please.
So two ideas have formed this one. And by the way, absolutely fabulous exam question, which I really enjoyed thinking about, Paul. It was good fun to do this. So two ideas underpin this one. And the first one takes me years and years and years back when I was doing my master's at the Institute of Education. And there was a module taught by Ron Barnett on the philosophy of education. And one idea that came up there, and I quite like it, is the idea that higher education is, or maybe should be, about the transformation of the individual as well as about knowledge. So it's not only about knowing stuff, it's about understanding complexity, the limits of knowledge, the impact of practice on understanding, the interaction between different fields of knowledge. So not just about knowing that, it's knowing why knowing that, as it were. Now, that's one of the ideas underpinning one of Ron's early books, The Idea of Education. And a thought I'd had there was all about, you know, does higher education have to be a group activity? Could a person marooned on a desert island with a limited supply of books genuinely have a higher education which was transformational in Ron Barnett's sense, or would they simply know a lot of stuff? And that, I don't know the answer to that question, but that was a puzzle set myself. So the second idea comes on, and it's the idea we all know, people say, oh yeah, I went to the University of Life. And the idea there that lessons are best learned not by being told something, not by sitting in a classroom, but by experiencing it. Now, there's a truth in that, of course. There's a huge truth in that. It could be about practice. It could be about reflection. But it's driven by the learner and what they do. Now, I think if you bring these two ideas together, you've got potentially a very interesting university. And that's what the university I'm trying to create today.
So it's... Hang on, right. So is it a is it a I'm just trying to get away from a desert island, right? But so you're not talking about sticking it all the students on individual desert islands, but it's about what happens to them and how they learn. Are they still in what might be described as a kind of conventional campus environment or similar?
They are, but not all the time. So what I'm imagining is that students attend university. Teaching is very different. You don't necessarily have a curriculum with courses. You do have academic staff who mentor, who tutor, who guide them through reading lists and through helping students manage their own learning journey. So it's a very intense, but it's a very one-to-one kind of relationship with tutor and academic and learner, with students attending that one. It's also the sort of thing where students might not attend for three consecutive years. In fact, they probably wouldn't. They would come in short blocks. They'd then go and live, because, you know, it's all about experiences and how you're using that. But the process is one which helps the student develop their learning and change as a person and in a different way. So there we are. So that's the context for it.
Okay. So we'll come on to more about the learning and teaching bit in a minute. I'm just trying to establish the physical presence for a start.
That's
fine.
But there's
an element which is traditional, which is that you have a series of buildings in which those admittedly intensive one-to-one activities or whatever they might may take place. That's really helpful. And
you have more than that. Let me jump in. Okay. Let me jump in there, because you do have physical buildings, and it's not just space for tutorials, because what you're doing is you're helping students have experiences. So you will have a really, really good library. You will have labs for any science engineering disciplines they might be doing. You will have workshops, you will have creative spaces, studio spaces. You'll have all of the equipment that can facilitate students learning, but it's available in a much less intense way.
On this campus, and so you've got all these amazing facilities, right?
Yes.
I must admit, I'd assumed that when you talked about students, you know, disappearing off to get their experiences, I'd assumed that they were going to, you know, to placements, to work environments, to laboratories and research facilities and engineering premises around the area, where they would be, you know, building on their learned experiences in the real world, as it were, rather than doing them on site. But they're doing both, I think, is what you're saying.
It's a bit of both, completely. I mean, it's a good mentoring, a good bit of tutorial might well involve, well, let's go and try that. Let's go and do the experiment. Let's go and do the thing. So it's not the case that students would be, you know, it's Wednesday morning, 10 o'clock, we'll have a session in the studio every week for the next 10 weeks. Yeah. But it might be this mentoring session needs to move into that space. But I'd expect students would be therefore dropping in and out of the labs and workshops things rather than using them all the time.
Yeah. OK. Right. So we've got a lot of facilities, very good library. Going back to what students are doing then. Right. And you talked about them being, you know, very much individuals, very much intensive tutoring. So if you've got people doing different forms of, you know, electrical engineering, say, are they all pursuing their own particular pathway? Do they come to all the electrical engineers in their first year come together? I mean, are there cohorts in the way that we traditionally understand them, or is basically everyone a kind of free floating individual just kind of wandering around?
Well, this, I think, so obviously there's an experimental nature to this.
Absolutely.
And I can't think that any university, probably since the 11th century, has done anything like this one. So let's not think there's currency in this one. But I think what I would see is that students, when they start, they meet with a panel of academics and between them work out a program of study. Is too grand a word, but it's a sort of shaped journey. So a set of expectations and mileposts about what they might do. And that's one student, the panel, they agree it. So every student has their own particular journey worked out. But equally, you would expect the students would use each other in some ways as resources for learning. So later on, we might talk about the Students' Union. And I'd imagine a one big point of the Students' Union is to enable students to create their own learning sets, their own learning groups, their own study groups, whatever it might be. So there's not a cohort per se, but there absolutely will be students who understand each other's program and might use each other's results to learn together. But by focusing on the individual, each student maximizes their own outputs and it really is tailored around their learning needs.
Right. Okay. So that is a novel approach for sure. So
I feared it might be.
Yeah. No. That's good. That's what we're wanting. This is an imaginary institution. So we're testing new ground here. So in terms of the scale of this institution, then, is it? I mean, are we talking very very small numbers, or are we talking a much larger offering? I'm just, because it could feel very different depending on the scale.
It does. I think we are feeling like an Institute of Advanced Study. We're feeling like a small community. So physically, I'm imagining have you been to Ashridge?
No.
Okay, so Ashridge, it's called something else. It's Holt International at Ashridge, but it's a Victorian pastiche of a medieval manor, and it is the most glorious place you can imagine being. It has proper mullioned windows, beautiful golden sandstone, enormous fireplaces that absolutely should have Errol Flynn jumping off and sword fighting on them, things like that, and grounds. And that's the sort of environment I think you're looking at. So it's comfortable to be learning. And therefore you've got a smallish community. I don't think you'd necessarily have to, 30 students only. You might get into the hundreds or maybe even a low thousand, but you wouldn't have 30,000. The mechanics of a large place are mind-boggling. And obviously there is an enormous endowment underpinning all this one. So let's not worry about the money, because somehow some multi-billionaire has decided that this is the thing that needs to have money put into it, and so it creates something we can do. So let's not, if we try to make this work financially, I fear it could fail marginally.
Yes. Yeah, I was going to ask that, but I'm glad you've put that one to bed. So in terms of the range of disciplines, it's basically anything on offer. If a student turns up and says, I want to look at, the medieval French, or I want to look at quantum computing. I mean, is it all on offer?
I think so, in principle. And it probably suggests that the faculty are going to be a mix of full-time permanent and visiting fractional, not kind of 2 hours a year sort of fractional, but a point two appointment to make sure we've got a professor of medieval French geography or whatever it might be. It's also, I mean, the nice thing about this is that you are going to have an environment where the staff are doing the kind of research-informed teaching and teaching-informed research which is a lot of the ideology behind British higher education in the last 200 years or so. So you'd expect the staff to be doing research of the sort you might find in an advanced research institute. The difference here being that you wouldn't have research teams that don't do teaching.
Yeah.
There's no buying out of teaching here. You've got to do both.
Talk to me more about the examples of collective activity then, right? Because there's a danger, is there not, that everyone ends up really lonely, and there is only one, person doing that medieval French geography or whatever, and they've got no friends. So how where are the collective instances? I mean, or is it, an avowedly, individualistic ethos?
I don't think you'd say the ethos was individualistic, but I think you also wouldn't program too much by way of forcing people into groups that they're not naturally going into. Right. So it happens by students' own volitions. And if we think about the sort of thing that will happen in a mentoring or tutoring meeting with an academic. So in fact, maybe it's easy. We start talking about the student journey, what happens all the way through there. So they start off, they agree with this panel of academics, a plan for their learning. And one academic, or maybe two or three, depending on what they're doing, will be assigned as their mentor, their tutor, whatever it might be. And it's up to them then to decide how it is they're going, them being the student here, to decide how they're going to make use of these facilities. There's no curriculum per se. There are absolutely criteria for assessment. There are absolutely criteria for how you demonstrate learning to get an award. But there aren't, you know, medieval French 101, physics 302. There's not those things. There are reading lists which the academics will prepare, which guide a student through all the different topics. And they will naturally be a mixture of things which are more basic texts through to more advanced journal articles, depending on how it goes there. But those are the tools the students use. So the tutorial or mentoring meetings are really a combination of, let's talk about the stuff you're learning in terms of knowledge, but also let's talk about how you are developing as a learner and are able to manage your own learning. So this goes to the idea of the learner. The former director of the Institute of Education, whose name I've temporarily forgotten, R.S. Peters. It was R.S. Peters and his notion of willingness and wittingness being the two key factors for conscious learning. So you need to learn, but you need to know you're learning. And this is part of what the tutor's doing, is helping students be conscious of their own learning. And that's the mechanism whereby the students take control, take ownership in a much more intense way than I suspect is happening at most class taught undergraduate experiences. Once you've got this, if a student is conscious of their own learning, they will know whether for them, or they'll explore and find out whether for them, library on their own or talk to some other learners are the best things for them, and that will naturally grow. And hence the students' union is the facilitation that facilitates the getting students together to learn, but it's driven by the students' own preferences for that stage in their journey.
So the student union then has got an extra, a real extra dimension to its activities. And so beyond the kind of social stuff and the sporting stuff and the support stuff and the representational stuff, it's also actually facilitating broader learning and engagement for the student body, which is a very different and additional, and I would say novel and welcome addition to student union activity.
Well, think Bologna 1088. I mean, this is the student nations. This is the students getting together to hire the teachers. And it's the students being the body that owns it all. And now this is obviously translated for a modern experience. But I think that notion, which is this is all about learning. And you'll get the sense this is a very serious place to be. I mean, yes, there almost certainly will be social stuff and sports, but it's not going to be your frat houses. It's not going to be Party Central and Rag Week and things like that, because this isn't the sort of learner who's going to come here. It's probably not for everyone.
So, going back to the sort of learner who gets it, then you talked about the process of joining. But I mean, presumably demand is overwhelming for this extraordinary experience.
You've clearly got a process for application. It will be, I'm sure, attractive to more mature learners. And I don't mean mature in age terms, although I probably do in some respects. I mean mature in ability to reflect on their own position and be self-aware of learners. So I think to myself at 18, and I needed the structure given to me by classes and timetables, things like that. I probably still would have had it now. I'm probably not the person this university would work for, but there are lots who could do. People who succeed at work-based learning programs like Middlesex have done, people who succeed at sort of self-directed learning through postgraduate stuff. They're the sort of learner this will appeal to. Yeah, it will be an attractive thing to do. And I think you would have a process of interview, which was people very much saying, you know, why would this be for me? Why would I be the right person to invest the resource of the university in teaching here? And one of the things the university would want to do, now to find my notes on this one, I think it's very much about how do you ensure that the student body isn't skewed one way or another. So I don't think this is social engineering, but I do think you would want to make sure that you've got a student body which is representative of society as a whole, rather than skewed towards one particular demographic. So I do think there's something which, at the moment, I don't think many UK universities have genuinely got this right yet. There's good practice in many places about how to do it, but really looking, are we looking at class, at sex, at ethnicity, at disability, at background life experiences? And because you're looking at a more mature student who almost certainly is coming with work experience of various sorts, you've got a lot more scope for getting an interesting student mix here.
And that's an overt aim, is to have that diversity.
I think so, because I do think there's something about that. It's clearly an enormous privilege to go to this university. I mean, it's got great resources. You've got huge tutorial support here. You would want to make sure that you weren't giving it away unreasonably to one group or another. And I'm deliberately putting it like that rather than contraposing it with existing patterns recruitment there, because I'm not sure what the biases might be in this place, but we're not having them. Whatever they are, we're not having them if you can avoid it.
Excellent. So wondering then about further differences from your traditional higher education institution that we know and love in the UK in particular today. One of the accusations that's always made about universities is that they are, you know, incredibly bureaucratic organisations with, you know, endless committees and meetings or whatever. I'm hoping you're not going to disappoint me and suggest that there are no committees or something like that. I mean, I'm hoping that there are a good number of serious committees here.
Of course there will be. Of course there will be, because you've got... Well, one of the things here is that it's a place which is taking each student's learning very seriously. So you're going to need to have, at the moment, I mean, in many universities, student progress is overseen by a mixture of data-driven insights from progress and by performance at module exam boards, or progression boards for the year, or failure to attend tutorial meetings, whatever it might be. To my mind, there's an opportunity here to do something quite different. And so let's take a different tack here. One of my previous employers, St. George's, we had a regular committee which oversaw the progress of students who were in difficulties for whatever reason, whether it was health, whether it was they'd had bad exam results, whatever it might be. And this gave a degree of shared attention to what's going to help the student get through or what's best for the student. And I can see something like this. So you have student progress committees. You have a range of things where they are much more intensively talking about each student's journey. How are they doing? What results are we seeing? Are they still in the right place for them? Do they need to interrupt their studies and go off and do a job for a while and come back to it? Do they need to change that? So you'll have a lot of things like that. So an intensive focus on that kind of thing. Clearly as well, you're going to have committees to manage the buildings and the estate and the labs and all this stuff like that. Yeah, great fun on that thing. Clearly, you're going to as well, if staff are being asked to do research-informed teaching and teaching-informed research, where the research committees, where the committees that oversee that one. But I think what we're going to see, because we are in a more individual focused environment, the committees are going to reflect those individual cases. So it will feel more like the exam boards that you and I might have supported in our early stage careers, where you did talk about individual students and results rather than the bulk processing that happens now, which is a necessary factor of scale and fairness. I mean, there's lots of good things about how things are done now, but I think you get back to that sort of approach. And you might find as well that the because this staff, you won't necessarily have a complement of hundreds of academic staff. You might have a core academic staff of 30 or 40, you know, someone in each discipline who understands enough about history to know what a historian looks like, but then you get in the part-time, the 0.2 FTE specialist in X to be the mentor of the student. So the committees will be interdisciplinary, always, and that is going to be a barrel of laughs.
Right, no, I get that. What about the other members of staff, the professional services and so forth, and indeed the senior leadership? I mean, are you the vice chancellor here? I just thought I should ask that question. I mean, I'm assuming you are, but you might not be. And if not, then who is? And if so, what kind of vice chancellor are you?
It's a really good question. And I'm tempted to go being a vice chancellor. I do like the gig. The key thing here is that, you know, in this university, contemplation is good, but swinging the lead is bad. So there's no coasting. And coasting might be a student who thinks, I'll just go and have a nice chill out for a couple of weeks. No, you won't. Not doing that. You're here to learn. So as a VC, I'm very much doing the vice chancellorship by wandering around and chatting to students, scaring the bejesus out of them by asking them, how's their learning going? What are they contemplating? What do they think they're doing? How are they doing on their journey? But equally, talking to academic staff on the same basis, wandering around, what's their mentoring? How's that helping them reflect on their own practice and knowledge in the discipline? How's that prompting their research? So it's very much a role of a VC in this one, I think, is about helping create a community out of individuals. Probably more than a job for one person. You might have a senior leadership team, which actually is people doing that. So, you know, PVCs who would do this sort of thing. A registrar who's really focused on individual student learner journeys. How do they come together? How do that all fit together? And fending off whatever regulatory regime we're in. I think most likely this is going to be in England, because that's where the scope of experimentation with the OFS's regime. But also, I mean, this university would really struggle with B3 metrics. And I think the registrar's basic job would be to fend off the OFS for as long as possible on this.
Excellent, excellent. That seems entirely appropriate. Are there other features then that we've not covered yet in this extraordinary institution? I mean, I am assuming from what you said earlier that the founding chancellor will be Ron Barnett, but I could be wrong there.
Oh, I think you'd have to. I think Ron would have to be a part in it somewhere. If you know, chair of the academic advisory board or chair of the council or the whatever it might be. But Ron, I mean, I have to say, in all seriousness, Ron Barnett, a really great teacher, a really interesting thinker about higher education.
Absolutely.
And
yeah,
hugely influential on my way of thinking about the roles of universities and how they do this. I do want to say a big thank you to Ron for being a great teacher on my MA millions of years ago, in the last millennium. We can say that, can't we? That sounds an awful long time ago. So other things to say about this place. I think let's pick on some of the, what are we like? I mean, I've mentioned Bologna a little bit. I mentioned a little bit kind of Middlesex and work-based learning as one of the aspirations here. I think we're also going for a tone which is something like Berlin in the 1820s. So when you got the first notions of Lehrfreiheit and Lernfreiheit, so the idea that students can choose what they want to learn, academics can choose what they want to research, and those principles which really underpin the notion of the research university as now conceived in the world. And I think that sense of radicalism, which must have been there in 1820, where previously universities had become by and large formalized training systems for medicine, for the clergy, for law. And I think that the shot that in the arm that came through that notion of let's actually take the Enlightenment ideas and put them into an institutional context where they can thrive, that's what we're looking at here. So it's somewhere that might revitalize notions of learning. And I think out of this, you will get graduates who will be very interesting people and who will do interesting things. But I can't predict what that will be at the moment. So that's one part of it. I think I've mentioned as well the idea of being an institute of advanced study. And if you look at the University of London in the School of Advanced Study there, you've got small institutes which might, you know, about the book, about law, about the Commonwealth, really specialised, deep study places, which push the boundaries of understanding of knowledge. And I think we talk about Asheridge, the environment, good thing like that one. I think that's the sort of thing which I'm looking for as a feel around the university, which might be there. Another thing to mention, when students do attend here, and my idea here is that a student probably has a course study, a period of study that might last 5 or 6 years to get a first degree, might be 3 or 4 years for a master's degree, and who knows for a PhD, and it'll do all the different levels. But the periods there on campus, they need just to focus. So your range of support services is huge. It's not just counselling and medicine and, you know, healthcare and things like that. You've got a really good creche, a really good nursery. You've got really good social care teams who can pick up where students have caring responsibilities for parents, for family members. So genuinely, when they've got there 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 8 weeks on campus, they are just learning. Did you ever go to Cumberland Lodge, Paul?
No.
It's a charity, and it's a one of the very fancy small houses, say small, it's about 80 bedrooms, in Windsor Great Park. Used to be a royal thing, and it's now run by a charity, has been for years. And in my first degree at LSE, the department went for a weekend retreat to Cumberland Lodge every year, and it's that sort of feel. So you go there, it's catered, it's beautiful bedrooms, it's just relaxing. You can really engage and think, we had great speakers, things like that. That's the kind of feel, right, I'm looking at to make the place work much better in a student's interest. So when a student's there, they really can engage with learning, and yeah, so the onus is on them to engage with learning. And if they don't, you've got to be quite firm about saying, well, you're not ready for this yet, or you're not on the right page, off you go and do a job for a bit. When you're here, you're thinking.
Yeah, well, that takes us to the next question. I mean, you mentioned earlier the no swinging the lead, right? I mean, are there things that are actively banned on campus? I mean, it's not very popular now to ban things, but you know, given that it's your university, you can do whatever you like. So are there things that students are actively not allowed to do or not allowed to behave like?
I don't think, I think the only point is seriousness. So it's, you know, students take learning seriously, and staff are serious about supporting learners and individual. Those two things are non-negotiable. And beyond that, get on with it. You know, so, clearly, you then have to watch out for the unhealthy relationships between staff and students. So here's one other thing. No relationship, any emotional, romantic attachment, sexual attachment between staff and students, absolutely forbidden.
Right.
That's it.
So someone's taken no relationship, no frivolity, obviously, as well. So
you can be frivolous. Frivolous is fine if it's part of your learning journey. I can't imagine if I'm a student there, I'm not going to be serious faced all the time, because I can't be. And laughter is learning. So you can imagine a student's experience of the sport learning might include stand up comedy. Why wouldn't it, if you're doing certain sorts of developing your own abilities and reflections? So you can have humour, you can have frivolity, but it's got to be purposeful frivolity, if that's not a contradiction in terms.
Focused frivolity, right.
Yes, yeah, you will now enjoy yourself between the hours of 10 and 11. Off you go.
So, yeah, so it's not an entirely, wholly serious and focused place. There is an element of fun on the agenda, albeit focused fun and frivolity. Right, Hugh, we're at the end of the exploration of this very novel institution at the moment, but there's one final thing, which is you need to have an anthem or a theme song. So what tune will this institution be known for and by?
So I had a long think about this one, and there were obviously lots of tempting possibilities. Schools Out had a decent amount of space in my head to decide that's the right answer, but it's not. I've gone much more highbrow, I'm afraid to say. So we're going for the first of Sarti's Nocien. It's got a tentative, reflective, minor key feel that I think is about right. It's the one that goes, it's that one.
Right.
You can edit that out if you want to. But it's got that kind of, so it's always making you slightly on edge. And I think that's something about this place. It'll be on edge. You've not asked me to give this place a name, Paul. Is that coming, or do you want me
to tell
you that?
Well, no, I mean, I would be delighted if you were to give it a name, Hugh. I thought you might have inserted it before now, or you may not have come up with one. So do please share the name of this institution with us.
Well, very simply, it's the University of Life.
No.
Because it already has a ready-made set of merchandise at every souvenir stall in London, Oxford, Cambridge, and where you like it. So I did contemplate, I don't go to university as being the right place on this one, but I think University of Life has a better ring to it.
It is the University of Life. Well, I never. Well, you will disappoint, people up and down the land when they discover that, in fact, that though they thought they'd been to the University of Life, it turns out that they. Hugh, thank you so much for coming up with that really terrific set of ideas for a remarkable institution, the University of Life. It's been really great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Not at all, Paul. Thank you so much for inviting me. I've had great fun doing it.
I do hope you enjoyed that episode of My Imaginary University. There'll be more along before you know it. In the meantime, you might want to listen to the sister podcast, University Registrars Talking About Stuff, in which I chat to university leaders and registrars and others like that, all about their experiences of higher education. Just Google it. Also, you may want to visit my website, wonderfulhighered.com, where you can find lots of entertaining stuff all about the strange, wonderful and frightening world of higher education. Anyway, until the next time, thank you for listening.